Hello, and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. During the month of November, the USIP Global Campus is offering our online course on conflict analysis, and the main instructor for that course is Jeff Helsing. He's the Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP, and he will also be my co-host for the podcast this month. Jeff, it's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Darren. It's good to be back, and we've had a good week so far, and I'm looking forward to a lot more interaction.
Excellent. And our guest for today's show is Dr. Sharon Morris. Sharon is Senior Advisor to the Acting President at USIP. Her research focuses on civilian assistance in fragile states and explores models that integrate peacebuilding and development. She also focuses on developing more rigorous approaches to measuring the impact of peacebuilding interventions. Her work draws on more than 15 years of experience designing and implementing conflict management and stabilization programs in places such as Afghanistan, Yemen, Iraq, Nigeria, and Somalia. Sharon, it's wonderful to have you on the show, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We're also joined by many listeners around the world, and we invite those of you tuning in online to connect with our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, who will be moderating your questions and instant messaging you during the broadcast. And we look to our listeners like you to help us guide this conversation. So we ask you to seize the opportunity to engage with our guest, and please notify Vanessa when you have a question or a comment by messaging your questions to her, and she can read that question for you on air. Or, if you have a microphone, we can unmute you and you can ask your question directly. So, Sharon, I'd like to start the show by turning to you. And the course, just to give you a little bit of background, that we're offering this month and that Jeff is teaching, as you know, focuses on conflict analysis. And the first week of the course, we looked at how the nature of deadly conflict has been changing, particularly since the end of the Cold War. And these changing and evolving dynamics of violent conflict further increases the need and the importance of conducting conflict analysis when we're working in communities that are impacted by violence. And so yesterday marked the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and so it seems timely to ask you, how do you think the nature of deadly conflict has changed since then, and why do you think those trends reinforce the need for conflict analysis?
That's a complicated question. Certainly, we're seeing a dramatic resurgence in violence over the past few years. I think for many of us in the field, it was a very optimistic time a handful of years ago. We thought we saw violence on the downswing. But lately, we've seen deeper expression of sectarian violence. We've seen violence over natural resources driven by climate change taking on greater urgency. The one thing about violence is it's going to continually change. It always does. And it's going to escalate in some periods and de-escalate in others. And, you know, getting a handle on that rapidly evolving the rapidly evolving dynamics is incredibly challenging. I honestly don't think there's an assessment framework in the world that's going to get us to all the answers we need. But certainly, I think as analysts, we can stay alert to the potential for change.
Jeff, you touched a little bit on that in the course this week, talking about, I think, not quoting you directly, but something along the lines of, there's no magic wand. There's no the conflict analysis framework that is going to work for everybody. So do you care to respond to some of what Sharon has shared so far?
Let me actually go back to your original question and then try and weave it together a little bit. The Berlin Wall 25 years ago, I actually was working at the time for an organization called the Institute for East-West Security Studies, and we're doing a lot of work in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And I had been in the former Soviet Union, then the Soviet Union, a number of places in Eastern Europe in the year leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And a lot of our analysis was based upon talking to the elites. These were reformers. These were people that are out ahead of the changes that were occurring, particularly in Hungary, where I'd spent quite a bit of time, but also in Poland, and a little bit in East Germany. And I remember that I was asked to give a public presentation in early November 1989, in which, based on my analysis, based on my discussions with the people in the government, the reformers, etc., I made the comment that it's on record somewhere that you will see a lot of changes and that they will be somewhat incremental, but over time that it will lead to something very significant, and the last thing that will happen is the Berlin Wall will come down. You know, thinking that's the pinnacle. That's the one thing that they were going to hold on to, you know, over time. And a week later, you know, there's the news and the wall's coming down and so on. And I remember, you know, wondering, you know, how could so many people, and you know, certainly wasn't just me, but so many people be so wrong. And in part, it was because we were only hearing some voices where we thought the power resided, where we thought the real action was going to come was sort of top-down, slow, incremental reforms. And I think what I've learned, and I think what we've tried to apply in the last 25 years, is a much richer sort of assessment of the conflict dynamics and where power and action and initiative may reside. What I think is really hard is how do you capture that in an organized, structural way so that, you know, anybody with a particular organization can then take a framework or take a set of priorities or a set of metrics and really do good analysis. What do we send people out into the field with that will lead to the kind of rich analysis that we need? And I think that's the challenge that we have. I think we understand the scope of the challenge. I'm just not sure we've yet got the formula right, if that makes sense. Mm.
Well, yeah, and I was just going to add on to that, Jeff. You know, you had your experience with the Berlin Wall. I had a similar experience much later when I was out looking at the potential for violence in Kyrgyzstan, and absolutely every analyst out there sort of made certain assumptions about where violence was going to originate, and everyone looked at the tensions between sort of Uzbeks and Kyrgyz and looked for the potential for violence to flare up, you know, sort of in mixed, ethnically mixed areas. You know, we had all sorts of frameworks that went out, and so they were actually looking at a more community level. They weren't just looking at sort of elite level dynamics. But we got the locus of violence completely wrong. And so when violence did ultimately break out again, I think it was in 2010, everyone's eyes were focused on the inter-ethnic communities for where the violence would come up from, and it was all originating in mono-ethnic communities. And so there's so much we don't know about where to focus, about, you know, how to, and frameworks can't really tell you that. I think there are some structured ways to go in and ask questions, but before we started this show, I was talking with both of you and saying that I think, you know, our frameworks need to be evolving and adapting as fast as violence, and that's a very challenging thing.
So are we overcomplicating it?
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, do we go back to sort of more simple, basic questions and a sort of, do we need more depth or do we need more breadth? Do we need to talk to more folks and get a different sort of a varied sense of what people are thinking, or do we need to really dig down into specific communities and get much more in depth?
So. Well, also, and there are two things that I heard from the stories that you all shared, and so I'd like to get some clarity on it. One is, you know, the belief that the Berlin Wall was just not going to fall, and there's just no chance of that, or in Kyrgyzstan that the nature or drivers of the conflict was, you know, X, Y, or Z, and that didn't end up to be the case. Now, do you believe that is because, and then Sharon, I'm hearing you, there are assumptions that are built into the frameworks or that are used or the questions that we ask, or is it also just not enough information? So is it too simple? And we're not really getting at some of those stories or perspectives that say, actually, I think the Berlin Wall is actually quite fragile. This thing is going to fall pretty soon, and those voices are just marginalized and not heard. So is it assumptions? Is it not deep enough? Or, as you stated, Jeff, is it just too complicated?
Oh, my.
Well, I think one of the things, and going back to the events and what was happening around the Berlin Wall, there are also really significant decisions that are taken or not taken that are very hard to predict. So individuals matter in this as well, and particularly leaders. So Mikhail Gorbachev's decision ultimately not to use force and to preclude ultimately the East Germans to not to use force was unpredictable. And that a leader of the Eastern Bloc was going to act so much different than his predecessors. How do you factor something like that into a really good conflict analysis framework? And I'm not sure. I don't know whether that's the unknowable factor that sort of makes any kind of model only so good, or whether, you know, we need to bring in, I don't know, the psychologist and the anthropologist to sort of help us also understand the human and social dimensions as well. So now I'm making the case for a more complicated sort of framework.
No. Yeah, I guess those were great questions. I'll try to answer some of them. I am starting to think that our conflict assessments and our conflict analysis needs to go into much more depth. When I used to work for the government, I worked for both USAID and state. I actually wrote USAID's initial conflict assessment framework, and it really was meant to sort of help development professionals see the breadth of the causes of violence. It was meant to structure those causes in sort of a understandable way, and it really was meant to look at a country overall and say, here are some of the big trends. And I still think there's a lot of value to that broad analysis. One of the things I'm noticing, though, is that those broad analyses are no longer very surprising. Mm-hmm. So I see all sorts of assessments coming out basically saying we need to think about poor governance, we need to think about competition over natural resources. Well, yeah, we know that. There's no surprise anymore to that. And yet there are some new dynamics emerging that I don't think we have a good handle on. So there's some demographic changes and demographic shifts, the growth of the youth population. You know, that's been around for a long time, but I really think we're starting to understand that more and there's more research on it. Or urbanization is a huge trend. And David Kilcullen's recent book really delves into how urbanization is going to be affecting future conflict. The breadth is still necessary as long as we add in some of these new issues and think about how they will shape violence. I do think, though, that when I left government and I started working for an NGO and I began to think about program design, so not just analysis, not just a discussion of the problem, but what do we do about it? That's when I began to move away from broad analyses and really start zeroing in on particular demographic groups or, you know, particular issues. So, for example, I was in the Swat Valley in Pakistan shortly after the Pakistani army had defeated the Taliban in the district. And one of the things that I thought was, this goes back to your question of assumptions, one of the things that was so interesting is when I was trying to understand why Maulana Fazlullah had such a widespread base of support among the region's youth, I got the same old answer I always get. I think a lot of people bring assumptions with them about the causes of violence. And so the answer I got was young, ignorant, unemployed Pashtuns were, you know, bought with a little cash and easily manipulated with fiery rhetoric. But if you dig deeper, it turns out that wasn't the story. And our assumptions were wrong, and it actually was young, upwardly mobile Pashtuns who wanted to make a difference but were prevented from doing so by feudal structures. And so, you know, I don't want to sort of go through the whole analysis, but the bottom line was assumptions, who I was talking to, And anybody who's going into a country sort of as an outsider is going to be talking to elites, people who speak in their own language. Even as an NGO worker, where I had greater access than as a government official, I was getting the views of elites. And it wasn't until I sort of broke out past that and, you know, was talking to the taxi drivers and to young people and that I got a different story. I do feel, though, that deeper analysis that gets beyond the standard narrative is where we need to go. Because without that, all the programs we were designing for young people in the Swat Valley were totally missing the point.
We've had a number of questions in the last week from some of our students who've actually asked the question in one way or another, so how deep is deep enough? And how do you know when you've gone deep enough? So in your work in the Swat Valley, what was it that made you go much further? And then how did you know when you'd gone far enough?
I think this is, I've often sort of struggled with how do you teach someone to be a good analyst? And I know that in USIP's framework, one of the first things you talk about is, you know, curiosity. And I think for me, once I've heard the same explanation for something over and over and over, I get bored with it. And I'm sure there's some truth to it. I don't for a second disagree with the notion that some young people join militant movements because they're unemployed or ignorant or have been manipulated. But to me, that's just a very convenient explanation somehow. I mean, it's awfully nice for us that, you know, everyone who joins a militant group we don't like is stupid and poor, right? So when I keep hearing that explanation over and over, I get frustrated with it. And so for me, when, you know, all the political leaders I was talking to, they were all giving me the same answer. And so I just kept pushing until I found someone who would give me a different answer. And that was kind of hard because, you know, feudal structures and social exclusion, these are big issues in SWAT. And it's very hard to get people to be honest with you. I tend to keep my eyes open for people who are uncomfortable in the discussion that I'm having, and I'll seek them out later. So I noticed when I was having a discussion with tribal elders, there was a younger man on the side who's just uncomfortable with the answers I was getting. And he really seemed like he wanted to say something, but he wasn't going to, right? I will seek out local research institutes because they have a level of access that I don't, but I know I've pushed far enough when I've gotten an answer I haven't heard before, I guess.
You mentioned a couple things. First was around when doing analysis and asking questions, it's at a certain kind of elite level, or sometimes it can tend to be at a certain elite level, and then also in what language are these questions being asked and these conversations being had. And, you know, we've offered a course here at USIP on working effectively with interpreters. And so I'd love to hear your perspective on what type of relationship you feel needs to be developed with an interpreter to have your question that has strategically and intentionally been put together and crafted to get at a certain element of the conflict. How do you work effectively with an interpreter to communicate what you're trying to get at?
Well, first of all, I never strategically and carefully put questions together that much. But yes, often I'll work with tandem teams of interpreters. So again, in Kyrgyzstan, I worked with both an Uzbek and a Kyrgyz interpreter because I knew this was right in the immediate aftermath of the violence. And I knew that some Uzbeks wouldn't be comfortable talking through someone who's Kyrgyz and vice versa. So often I will try and have, you know, interpreters from all sides of the conflict. I have been in many situations where the interpreter has a clear agenda, and that becomes obvious within one or two interviews. And so, you know, I'll have discussions with interpreters about how I really just need them to convey the information they're getting and to not elaborate and to not fill in. But it's challenging. And again, that's, you know, you just have to keep asking as many people as possible. And, you know, if you feel like your interpreter isn't giving you all the information or is filtering it in some ways, you find another one. It's never easy, but I've absolutely changed interpreters midway through an assessment and gotten a very different picture when I've done that.
Interesting. Love to hear questions from our listeners online. If you have any questions for Sharon or Jeff, or if you have your own experiences working with an interpreter, or when do you feel that you've gone deep enough in your analysis, we'd love to hear your perspectives as well. Jeff, did you have any other questions around this issue of interpreters or going deep enough in your analysis?
Well, one of the questions that I keep coming back to is to what degree is conflict analysis simply a snapshot? Mm-hmm. And to what degree can we develop analysis that enables us to see a more fluid, changing, dynamic situation? You know, oftentimes we get wound up with looking at specific metrics, and oftentimes those can be fairly static. Mm-hmm. So how do we get at sort of the changeability or the dynamism of situations?
I think that is where you start to see the lines between conflict analysis, program design, and monitoring, as opposed to monitoring and evaluation. It all starts to blur. I'm finding it increasingly difficult to separate those three things out. I mentioned to you that the way I do analysis changed once I went to an NGO and once I started to think about designing programs. You don't think about designing a program for a whole country, right? You think about designing a program in a particular region for a particular issue, whether it's a youth program in SWAT or whether it's a managing violence over natural resources in northern Somalia. So, you know, as you dive in and do that sort of finer grained analysis, I have found that you begin to develop partnerships. So in Pakistan, there was a local research institute that was doing a lot of very interesting survey data with young people in the region, young people I couldn't reach and never will be able to reach again as an outsider. In Somalia, we worked with local partners, and they were sort of monitoring the state of environmental degradation over time. So, you know, as you go deeper into your analysis, I think it becomes easier to track changes over time because you're not looking across a whole country, you're looking at a specific issue. But then I think, you know, analysis should not be separated from your program design and implementation. So the analysis shapes the design, but then as you're implementing your program, you should never stop, you know, reaching out to the young people, not just the ones who are in your program, but sort of more broadly in the region to sort of get a read on where things are going as you're implementing your program. And that, again, feeds into course corrections as you implement your program. Or you should never stop looking at, you know, sort of patterns of deforestation or patterns of competition and violence over natural resources in Somalia. So, you know, again, you're not looking at everything, but you've got a deeper and richer understanding of the fluid nature of the conflict as it relates to a specific thing. And to me, that's not just analysis, that's design and monitoring as well.
And there's an awareness of a number of different layers of factors in structural challenges that have to be part and parcel of how you're going to be able to effectively do the programming.
Yeah.
That's why I think we keep going back and forth between the great simplicity and beauty of a very nice, easy analysis with the depth and the comprehensiveness that you want, and so how do you blend sort of the elegance and simplicity on the one hand and the need to know so much and to be able to really do it right, taking in all those factors. And I think that's the discussion we have is balancing that out.
I think, you know, if you look at sort of the way we, in Somalia, for example, you know, the assessment and the design were a microcosm of this broader framework, right? So we absolutely looked at things like, clashes between formal and informal governance structures, and that fed into our design. So we wanted to make sure that we had clan elders and religious leaders and business leaders and formal government officials all engaged in dealing with this issue because we knew that was a potent underlying source of conflict. We wanted to understand the markets in the area and the fact that women and youth were engaged in charcoal production, which is, you know, environmentally very damaging, and that anything that was done around this, around sort of reducing charcoal production, was going to have a very negative impact on their ability to earn a living. So, I mean, the thing is, when you do an assessment, a deeper assessment in a more defined area, you're still looking at all of the different factors that you would in a much broader assessment, but you can go into greater depth. And so you look at the structural factors, you look at the actors, you look at the dynamics. So the frameworks still help, but you know, you do have to peg it more tightly.
We have a question from one of our listeners.
Yeah, we have two questions from two different participants. I'll start with the first. When you guys are ready, you can let me know and I'll read the second. The first set of questions comes from Diana. She asks, why don't we involve diasporas in work in their countries? More multi-sectoral teams involved in the conflict analysis with diasporas from several professions. What is the ideal team to conduct a conflict analysis?
I think it would be great to get diaspora communities more deeply engaged. I don't know why it hasn't happened. I know I've tried to figure this one out for quite a while as well. There was an Office of Diaspora Affairs at State for a while, but just finding funding for it is always challenging. Assessments tend to be a bit of a luxury. You know, most people drop in for a week and, you know, just ask the questions they can and then zoom back out again. It's never enough time. The other thing, though, I would say about diaspora communities is you have to be very careful of bias. Mm-hmm. There, you know, people leave their countries for a reason and probably for very powerful reasons. And, you know, I think one of the most famous examples is the diaspora, the Sri Lankan diaspora community. You know, it was very heavily LTTE. And so, you know, you're going to be getting certain views if you tap into the diaspora community, and you have to be careful to balance those views with folks inside the country. So,
the question of diasporas, like with any organization, is that is there an agenda? And so what you have to do, it seems, is build on the networks, the connections, but in a way that still works within one's own objectives and programming needs, and not get caught up into or not enable the process to get captured by the agenda that diasporas may in fact have. And you also have to really understand the situation, because it can be counterproductive simply to begin doing something with somebody from the diaspora if you don't understand how they're perceived by those in the country or in a community, and the degree to which over time they themselves may have a non-realistic view of the situation on the ground. And so it would certainly require a lot of, I would say, good understanding and preparatory work in order to make the best use of diasporas, but certainly a resource that could be potentially very useful.
I was just going to speak to the second part of your question, which was sort of how do you build an effective multi-sectoral team? This is a much longer question. We can return to it if this isn't a good enough answer, but I've sort of, again, come around to the notion that sort of big multi-sectoral teams are just too complicated, and more and more I've been looking at just two sector teams. And so, for example, I've been very interested in exploring the intersection between economics and conflict. And so I went with a colleague who is an economic development professional, and he and I went into the Niger Delta, and we were really wanting to zero in on, you know, how does violence affect markets? How do economic issues affect conflict in the Delta? And because we narrowed the focus, the sectoral focus, I think, we got a much richer analysis than if we'd also included governance, and if we'd also included natural resource management, we'd also included, you know, 17, because everything's related to everything. So again, I'm just finding that if you narrow the scope of the analysis, this doesn't mean that you're not drawing on sort of generalizable trends and patterns that you can take. This is not an argument for, you know, you can't learn anything across countries. But it does allow you to really tease out the richness and the complexity of the relationship between economics and a conflict in a way that you couldn't if you added all sorts of sectors to it. So hope that's a good answer.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. We're joined today, my co-host is Jeff Helsing, our guest is Dr. Sharon Morris, and again, I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and we're going to turn to another question or comment from one of our listeners, Vanessa.
Yep. There were two questions I was originally going to start with. The second question is from Carrie and was in reference to Sharon's comment about program design and monitoring. But while we were talking about Diana's question, Helen had some pushback for Jeff and Sharon. She wrote, "Don't you think diaspora views would help in highlighting the most often unofficial views, realistic or unrealistic?"
So if I understand the question, Helen is saying that diaspora communities are going to be an effective representation of the non-government or the unofficial view?
Correct.
Sure, but, you know, these things aren't monolithic. There is no government view, there is no unofficial view. There are, you know, 100 unofficial views and 100 government views, and the diaspora is one slice of the unofficial view in the same way that, you know, one tribal group may be another slice, and women from a marginalized ethnic community may be another slice. And so, you know, I think it's just important to recognize that there are many, many views of the world and views of violence. And if you pick one, you've picked one. You're not getting a full range.
You can also add to that, in some cases, diasporas, particularly those who are get actively involved, may also bring with them resources. And some of it's financial, which can be a positive influx, but also sometimes can create barriers with the people on the ground. And I've been in places where there's a lot of resentment of diasporas. And it's not just that they may have a different agenda, it's that they have, they are seen as competing power centers or resource centers with the government. So it's almost, you know, some people, I've been in communities where they said, we don't want either one. So it's anti-government and anti-diaspora, particularly diaspora who may come in through economic development and their own particular programs, and that can be dislocating in a different way.
I'll also add that diasporas themselves are not a monolith as well.
Right, for sure.
You know, having worked with some diaspora communities that are essentially fighting for representing the same thing, they go very different approaches. Some might want to go the more political U.S. government route. Some might want to go the more United Nations human rights route. And there
some
can be a lot of...
Some might want to go the militant route.
The militant route, exactly. So there's a lot of fractures within them. So to mobilize even a diaspora group around a conflict analysis process could be quite challenging.
For sure.
So this is Carrie's question, and it was in reference to your comment, Sharon, about program design and monitoring. She writes, "Isn't part of the problem that there are so many different organizations doing conflict analysis within the context of their particular program, creating disjointed or competing agendas? How do you try to create harmony without burdening organizations with complicated, large-scope analyses?"
You know, again, this gets back to this issue of needing both types of assessment. And again, the assessments I did while I was in government were much broader because I think, you know, government officials, you know, embassies, the UN, they need that broader view and need to sort of understand how all the different pieces add in together. Doing an in-depth analysis so that you design more effective programs isn't necessarily going to lead to competing agendas, right? So let's say... you want to do peace-building work in the Niger Delta. If somebody goes in and does a broad assessment and identifies three critical things you need to address, you need to address youth engagement, you need to address natural resource management, you need to address poor governance. Okay, good. You've got those three areas you need to think about. Then you really do need to go into depth in the youth space to understand what kind of youth program you would develop. So again, I don't think it's necessarily that by going into that depth, individual implementing partners are somehow developing competing agendas. I may not have fully understood the question. You need a broader view, but you cannot implement a broader view. You can only implement a program. And for that program, you need to do a rich and in-depth analysis.
Another question from one of our listeners, or a comment from one of our listeners.
Yes. This listener actually submitted a question beforehand because he couldn't listen. So he's going to download this specifically for this particular part. So this is Moses John from South Sudan who wrote in, whose analysis of conflict counts? Is there a way to reconcile analysis of different actors in a conflict situation as a foundation for peace building?
That's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. I know. Because you want to take that one, John?
Well, I'm going to start. Let's talk about it, because I'd like to sort of unpack the question a little bit. Whose analysis counts? You know, there's, I think, part of the conflict analysis that's done by outside organizations is really to, part of the process is to really determine, I suppose, what is the authentic expression of the needs, the perceptions, the interests that exist within a particular community or region, whatever your level of analysis is. And so at least from my standpoint, I think good conflict analysis done by an outside institution or organization is looking for that, the authentic, the best conflict analysis or the voice from the local community that then gets, I don't know if the word would be filtered, but it gets incorporated into and influences the programming that you're talking about, and that, and also, particularly if you think about, I would say, conflict resolution or peace building, is also matched up with or is incorporated into our understanding, our being sort of the broader field, understanding of conflict dynamics and those things that are necessary for sustained peace building. But whatever we would do in terms of our programming, in terms of conflict management, in terms of peace building related programs, if we don't really find the authentic or relevant voices from within the society, everything's going to be skewed. So I think the key is how to match those different dimensions up. But it's certainly something to keep thinking about further. And so that's my first initial impression. I don't know what you think. I may change my mind a little bit down the line here.
Well, it is a really interesting question. I think my first response would be that everybody's analysis counts. I do think there's, and I don't think that this is what the questioner is saying, but I think this is a mistake that many folks make. You know, you don't, as an analyst, you don't get to pick and choose whose story is more accurate, whose story is more right, writer. You know, I think a lot of people bring a certain level of distaste or moral sensibilities to analysis, and that's a huge problem. So, for example, I was in Darfur, you know, again, sort of trying to get a better handle on the violence there, and the woman I was traveling with, you know, she absolutely had a problem, you know, with what had happened there, and there were a number of groups. She really didn't, you know, she felt their views were illegitimate. And, you know, I kept insisting that, you know, we had to talk to perpetrators of the violence as much as we talked to victims of the violence. I would push back, this sounds bad, I would push back quite hard on sort of the narrative that it was all, you know, bad people on the Janjaweed side who were doing this. I just, you know, you really have to get in there and wade around, and you can't discount anybody's story. So, you know, I ended up having a very interesting and meeting with a number of folks from a northern tribe who absolutely and truly believed that what they had done was justified, was necessary to their survival. And so for me to discount that or to say that the Four story was more authentic or counted more would have made it very difficult for me as an analyst to truly address the issues. And so I definitely think you have to get rid of that anytime you go in and do this type of analysis.
I was going to, a lot of this conversation, I think, begs the question around objectivity and subjectivity. And I bring this up because, one, Jeff, in this week, you talked about a simple and elegant conflict analysis rooted in the five W's, you know, something that a journalism student learns when they learn that skill set, who, what, when, where, and why. And of course, there's this principle of objectivity in journalism, but a lot of people will challenge that as well and say, can you truly be objective in how you tell a story? So let's bring that to conflict analysis. Is it even possible as an analyst, even if you are not a party to the conflict and you are an outsider and you're analyzing, is it possible to be objective in your analysis?
No. And I mean, yes and no. So I guess one of the things, and I don't know if this, you know, everybody has a narrative about violence, and you just can't get caught up in anybody's narrative, right? And I find that I almost always have a great deal of sympathy for both sides in a conflict. And the fact that the West always wants to pick a good guy and a bad guy, you know, that's just what we do, and that's what people do to make sense of their lives. But I can certainly go into a place like Darfur and see the devastation and absolutely be completely unobjective about what happened there. It was horrifying what happened there. And I'm not objective. I think the people who perpetrated that violence, you know, deserve to go to criminal court and all those things. So in that sense, I'm not at all objective. But again, in the way, you know, nothing's monolithic. You have to peel back the layers and you have to go much deeper than the sort of big who's right, big who's wrong, you know, atrocity versus, and you have to look underneath it and understand that there are people who participated in the violence, and for them, you know, you have to understand what motivated, and you have to have some sympathy for it, or you'll never really understand why they're doing what they do. So, empathy, I think, is a pretty important part of doing effective analysis.
This idea of empathy, and then earlier you said, you know, kind of pushing back on someone who was expressing disdain or didn't feel that someone else's version of the story was one that was worth kind of integrating into analysis or understanding. And one of the concepts that we're looking at this week in the course is this idea of adaptive leadership. And Matt Levenger talks a bit about this. And, you know, he explains this as leading in situations where one does not have the authority to command. Actually, he refers to this as lateral leadership, leading in situations where one does not have the authority to command. And this means, when you're in that situation, creating a narrative of the conflict that tries to weave together all disparate realities of the involved actors, but with the aim to frame a solution to the shared problem. And so I think you've touched on this a bit, on empathy, but how do you gather information to create a solution-oriented narrative without doing any harm? Because as you said, some people might say, I can't believe you're actually taking this story seriously, or you're giving this person or this group time to shape this narrative. So what are some other examples of how to, one, exercise that empathy, demonstrate that empathy, but also work with these disparate groups that clearly do not see eye to eye on what the story and narrative is?
Wow, Matt is way more articulate than I am. I'm going to take that quote. And yeah, this is one of the reasons, again, why I tend to take multiple interpreters. The woman I was traveling with in Darfur, I mean, she really was very upset at a certain point when I kept, you know, showing a certain amount of empathy for the folks who were perpetrating the genocide. And again, to say that I was showing empathy for the folks perpetrating the genocide, I'm not, right? But there were young people who were sucked into this and who really, truly didn't understand it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to get myself into a lot of trouble on this one. So anyway, the woman I was with, I mean, she really was deeply frustrated. She said, why are you trying to absolve them of responsibility, right? And why are you trying to justify what they did? And it led to some very difficult conversations, and you have to be willing to have those. And you have to be deeply respectful to all sides. I have absolutely crossed the line in some contexts, and I've had people get very, very angry with me for questions that I've asked. And you know, you apologize profusely and you try to explain why it is what you're doing, but you can't not continue to explore distasteful views. Conflict is a horrible, horrible thing. And you can't get in there. I mean, to start, again, this whole do no harm thing, I mean, of course I believe in it. And yet, I don't think it's possible to go into a conflict situation. You know, there is so much trauma, there is so much hate, there are so many bad feelings. To go in and pretend that you're not going to cause some harm is yeah, that's a fiction.
Mm. Yeah. Jeff, your thoughts on that?
Well, and it's also, I think, very much, it's critical to understand that narratives are not just a contest between whose view of history and what the facts are. It's about that there's psychology and perception that is involved. And in order to understand the broader conflict dynamics and context, it's really important to understand, as you point out, Sharon, the narratives of the different parties and stakeholders.
Right.
So here's one of the things where I think conflict dynamics is important to help us think this through. And that goes to the oft-used quote about one group versus another, in which each side see themselves as a victim, and they phrase it in the following way: I don't hate the other for what they do to me, I hate them for what they make me do to them. Mm-hmm. And this mutual victimhood and how it gets sort of phrased in that way, and you can apply that quote to so many different conflicts of the last 25 years, and that's what's important to try and understand. And I think what you're talking about, this empathy, is not so much an empathy for someone using violence,
oh, no.
But it's an empathy to understand that they see themselves as victims, and that mm-hmm. it's a way in which we as human beings justify what we're doing, because even for some of the worst offenders, there is still some sense of trying to grasp to some kind of humanity to it all, mm-hmm. so that it's natural for me as a human being to do this because I was forced to do it.
Right.
And that's...
I was under threat, or my community right. was under threat, and if it hadn't been me, it would have, yeah.
That's right, because if we don't do it to them, they'll do it to us. And it, yeah. and that has to be understood.
And these are powerful narratives.
That's right.
I mean, they run so deep. I mean, to go back to the example I started with in Pakistan, you know, as I was sort of digging underneath the surface of the sort of standard explanation for why young people joined this militant movement, you know, when I really did begin to hear a richer and more interesting narrative, you know, there was absolutely a part of me that thought, well, sure, if I were a young, upwardly mobile Pashtun in the Swat Valley and I were being, you know, held down by these awful feudal barriers that don't allow me to have any kind of life, and it doesn't matter if I'm smart, and it doesn't matter if I've traveled to the Gulf, and it doesn't matter if I have some money in my pockets, I mean, nothing will ever allow me to have a meaningful life in this society. And this militant leader comes along and says, you know, let's overthrow this society, let's get rid of it. And, you know, there's part of me that says, well, sure, I'd do that too. And I just wrote a short article on foreignpolicy.com about this, and I think, you know, and I was really interested in the reaction I was getting from places like Pakistan and in the Middle East, where a lot of people were saying, yes, right? Absolutely. You know, you can't just demonize these folks because we disagree with them and because they're doing awful things, right? You can demonize the awful things they do, but you have to understand the story that they have told themselves that gets them to where they are. And you have to understand the truth in that story as well.
You have talked and mentioned a couple times in the show so far, specifically mentioning youth. And I know that prior to joining USIP, you worked at Mercy Corps and you worked primarily with youth there. And so I'd like to dig a little bit deeper in terms of your interest and the value that you place on youth and their role in conflict and resolving conflict. And also touch on another concept that was brought up this week in the course, and that's the concept of resilience. Hmm. And it was referred to as a buzzword. I think Matt, one of the course instructors, referred to it as a buzzword. But essentially, the way that it's been defined in the course is that it's the capacity of a system to respond to shocks and to reorganize dynamically in order to maintain its core. And so I'd like to ask you, Sharon, what role you see young people, youth in general, in building, establishing, strengthening the resilience of the community of which they are a part. Do you think they play a unique role in that? And actually, even backing up a little further, what are your thoughts on this concept of resilience?
Oh my goodness. Those are huge questions again.
I like the big questions.
Yeah, I know. Thanks. Obviously, I think young people play a central role in both violence and peace. I think, you know, they're disproportionately affected by violence. There's some fascinating research coming out now about adolescent brain development, what happens to adolescent brains and why, parts of the brain mature later up until the early 20s that really can help explain that young people really do want to, you know, there's a sense of urgency. They want to change the world. They want to have a sense of meaning. They want to make things right in a much more profound way than adults and children do. And so, you know, I think young people absolutely are at the heart of movements for both peace and violence. I think one of the things, you know, we tend to look at young people and everyone starts to sing, you know, they are our hope for the future kind of thing. I think we need to understand that young people are people and that violence has some profoundly distorting effects and that are particularly difficult for young people. So there's something that happens to young people's brains. There's this explosion of synaptic growth. Brains, you know, grow dramatically up until about the age of 12. And then about from 12 to the early 20s, what happens, it's called a process of synaptic pruning. Sorry to get a little geeky here, but what happens is during that period, young people begin to sort of shed the connections that they don't need, and they strengthen the connections they do need. And that's what a big part of maturing is you can't do everything. You have to begin to specialize and focus. So young people who come of age in a period of violence are learning certain lessons that are very, very difficult to unlearn later. And so you are learning lessons about the fact that you can't trust anyone, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're learning lessons about the fact that the only way to earn respect is to carry a gun. Or you're learning lessons about the fact that, you know, zero-sum competition, you know, is the only kind of competition. There is no way to compromise. So there's a number of very, very difficult things, lessons that young people are learning in violence. And I don't think we've thought enough about how to help young people unlearn those lessons. So when and we also need to look at what trauma does to young people in particular. If you look at so many of the youth programs out there, none of them are grappling with these sort of less visible issues. We have youth employment programs, but we don't stop to think about the fact that young people who have PTSD, you know, can't function in a jobs program. Or young people who don't believe there's a future have absolutely zero incentive to go to school, to invest in themselves, to invest in savings programs. So I think this sort of youth equals resilience is, that's too easy. I think young people do have the potential to make a very powerful contribution to peace, and we have to be realistic about what happens in violence and how we help them get beyond that to realize their potential.
No, I think this idea of synaptic pruning is brilliant, and we actually have another question or comment from, no? What do we have?
We do.
All right.
Jennifer has been adamantly commenting as we've been going along. The most recent thing that she contributed, she writes, "The complexity of taking the other side in the face of those who are injured and supporting the depth of humanness that needs to be valued. In any case, is this an intuitive practice in conflict analysis, or is it something that's a gap right now?"
Is it a gap? I guess I'll answer the question this way. Oftentimes we get focused a lot on things that we can measure, things that we can sort of understand as metrics of what we need to look for that give us some early warning or sense of the conflict situation. And so in the sense of the gap, I would say that we need to layer onto that the kind of perspective and understanding the different narratives and different perceptions that Sharon's talking about. So in that sense, I'm not so sure I would say it's a gap. It's just another very important layer that helps us understand the situation in ways that isn't just about quantifiable things, but also using our analysis and understanding of people, particularly that are in these situations, that are faced with trauma or have these long narratives, to understand how they might be perceiving the situation.
I think the only gap that currently exists, I mean, I completely agree with what Jeff said. I think the only gap that exists, and it's one that's been recognized for a long time in this space, you know, I can't talk to all the people I need to talk to when I go into a conflict assessment. There are people who just won't talk to me. They're huge categories of actors for whom I am completely illegitimate, you know? And I think we need to recognize that that just is, and there are limits to how we can get around that. I think probably the biggest gap I've seen to date is that we're not drawing enough on local research partners when we do our conflict assessments. Some of the best information I've gotten is from small, you know, shoestring local NGOs that are doing research on this stuff. I've been on way too many conflict assessments where I've got this, you know, super highly educated team that goes out and sits in a community and asks the community over and over again the same questions. And these are questions that, quite frankly, it's tough for a community to answer, you know? And so, you know, going to the people who have spent their lives studying these issues is again, I think, a gap. And so when I go out and do a conflict assessment, one of the first things I do is I'll hit local universities and I'll try and find PhD students at local universities who've studied these issues, because they are going to have, you know, information and focus that, you know, local communities aren't always going to have this stuff. So again, we just really need to be a lot more thoughtful about how we're getting our information and who we're getting it from. Good conflict assessment does not mean trotting around at the grassroots level asking, you know, everybody the same questions.
Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end of our show, but we do have one final question, and it ties in a lot of the things that you've mentioned over the last hour. There was a point that was emphasized in the material for this week in the course, and that is to become a reflective practitioner and the role that conflict analysis plays in having us become a reflective practitioner. So this is understood broadly as someone who can observe, reflect, and then is willing to learn as the dynamics of a conflict zone evolve and transform, including their own involvement and their interaction. And you talked earlier about your shift into more program design. Do you think it's possible to actively incorporate this notion of being a reflective practitioner into the design of a program?
I would hope so. Yeah, I mean, for everyone in the course who's just starting out, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I've done, you know, hundreds of conflict assessments, and I'm still learning and I'm still questioning, you know, the research that I bring with me, the body of knowledge I have with me. I tend to be one of those people who's never satisfied with the first answer. And so, yes, I mean, I think to be a good analyst, you always have to be reflecting. You always have to be pushing your own boundaries. You have to be pushing boundaries in the field. You have to be questioning received wisdom. You can't be satisfied with you know, sort of what you know, everyone assumes is obvious. I think the same is true for program design. I believe very, very deeply in measuring the impact of programs and in monitoring and evaluation, because that's the only way you truly can reflect and see, you know, did it work? Did it do what we wanted it to? So yes, I mean, you have to be reflective throughout, particularly in program design, right? Because otherwise, if it's not working, if we're not learning, if we're not shifting, we're wasting money, and why are we doing this?
Let me just add, yeah. Because I've spent a lot of time talking to John Paul Lederach, who is somebody who wrote a book on being a reflective practitioner. And I think what we've heard for the last hour is that you very much embody the kind of reflective practitioner that John Paul and others talk about. And I just think the discussion that we've had, particularly what you've added to the course, is being a reflective practitioner. And that doesn't mean you have all the answers. It's how you struggle with the questions and how you continue to think about how do we really do a better job of analyzing conflict and its practical effect, which is on the programming side, so that we really develop good conflict management and peace-building programs.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. Our guest on today's show has been Dr. Sharon Morish. She is a senior advisor to the acting president here at USIP, and my co-host for today's show has been Jeff Helsing, and he is also the main instructor in the course that we've been offering this month on the Global Campus that looks at conflict analysis. I want to thank all of our listeners who have tuned in from around the world for all of your deep listening, your questions, and your comments. I have been your host, Darren Cambridge, and I look forward to seeing you all next week on the show.